Playwright Alicia Mena drew on past experiences from her first failed tamalada with a friend to create her play, Las Nuevas Tamaleras.
When I came back, I find her on the table, doing the masa, and I'm going, oh my God, Betty, get down from there.
More on this San Antonio tradition on the next Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping employers get their people home safely. Preventing workplace accidents protects families and keeps businesses productive. More at texasmutual.com.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Racism is baked into the fabric of our society, from many of our laws and practices in our society to how our cities are constructed, and also into the algorithms and new technology that's being developed. There is evidence of racism right there. If you know what to look for, it's right there. And there are ways to fight back, but not exactly fighting, but by loving life and helping others in the smallest of ways. Ruha Benjamin has written the book about that, Viral Justice: How We Grow the World We Want, the idea that a small, minute change in a day-to-day life will eventually add up to solve problems of anti-Black violence in our society, and focuses on individual stories to unpack the habit and decisions that can ultimately lead to change. And so, Ruha Benjamin, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell me about the name Viral Justice. We all know what viral is. We see memes and videos go viral all the time. Is that what you're looking for?
Well, I'm also talking about viral as in this virus that has turned the planet upside down over the last few years. I think if something so microscopic can have such a powerful effect in the negative direction, why don't we learn from that and think about how we can channel seemingly small microscopic changes, habits, decisions, actions, but in a positive direction, in a way that's life-affirming, that brings us together rather than separates us. So it's about respecting the small things.
And so small viral things, the viruses, you know, they get into your DNA and they change how you are at the most fundamental level. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, you know, Dave, I'm trained as a sociologist, and so that means often looking at the big picture, looking at structures and institutions and large patterns. And I think sometimes as a sociologist, we can forget that people, everyday people, make up institutions. Human beings make up systems. And so when we want to talk about things changing at the institutional or at the systemic level, we can't overlook the role of individuals and how we make up those changes. And so exactly how you said, in terms of how it gets under our skin into our DNA, what about the cultural DNA of our nation? What are the grounding truths that often tear us apart, that are part of that underlying default setting of our culture? How can we change that for the better?
So as a sociologist, and in your previous work that many of us are familiar with, you look at the big picture and the how these systems work and operate and against us many times. But in this book, you're making it an appeal to the individual. Was that a change for you?
Yeah, it was. You know, it was born out of the twin crises of COVID, you know, the public health crises, but also of police violence in spring 2020. And I was looking around and I was seeing individuals rising up in their communities, in their neighborhoods, creating mutual aid networks, standing together to combat police violence. And it just made me look again and respect the role of individuals. And so I think we each have a role to play, and it's going to be different. What I do in my line of work, in my community, in my family, has to be different than what you do and what a listener is doing. And so part of the challenge is to understand that we need it all. We need everyone to look under their own feet. And if you're a teacher, think about how racism and inequality is impacting your school or your classroom. If you're a healthcare worker, looking at your clinic or your institution. If you are a stay-at-home parent, thinking about the kinds of messages that you're teaching the next generation, that's vital. And so part of it is to include all of us in the change that we want to see, rather than just holding up a few experts or a few talking heads and policy wonks and waiting for them to decide for us which direction we're going to go.
So how we grow the world we want. Typically step one in figuring out how to change the world is you got to know what kind of world you want to get to. So what is the world you want?
And so I think that is part of step one, and also thinking about what is currently ailing us. What do we not want? I think sometimes that can be easier to answer to begin with. And so growing the world we want has two parts. One is uprooting the things that are ailing us, the things that are tearing us apart, and then seeding the kinds of things that we want more of. And it's going to be context dependent. So let's look at education. I spend one of the chapters, which is called Lies, looking at our educational system and all of the kinds of lies that are told and that we perpetuate under the guise of learning and education. And so if we think about how, for example, if I'm a teacher and I have a student in my classroom who's being disruptive, let's say, and oftentimes the way that we address that is through a kind of crude kinds of punishment, detention, suspension. We had a case a few years ago in which a teenager in South Carolina, Shakara, was on her phone and the teacher called the police officer in and he body slammed her out of her desk. And that is a symptom of what we don't want, this kind of punitive, reactive mode to young people who are having a hard time. So then we have to ask in that specific context, what do we want? What kind of world do we want to respond to someone like Shakara? What does it mean to get to the root cause of, let's say, disciplinary problems? I don't think you can teach people who you don't care about. And so getting to the root cause is making sure that people who are educators actually genuinely care about all of the young people in their charge, in their classrooms, because then you can start to get to the root cause of whatever is causing a disruption, let's say, whatever is causing them not to want to pay attention, rather than just reacting to how they're behaving in the moment. And so that's just one example where we have to be really specific and look right under our feet and think, what's not working in this context? And how could we get to the root cause and address it in a way that is life-affirming, that values and respects the people that we're interacting with?
But also the trauma-informed response to a child in a classroom who won't get off their phone or is having a tough time, rather than reaching for the paddle, as is now becoming back in vogue in Florida, we're seeing Governor DeSantis calling for that type of school response. Instead, looking at the child and trying to understand where they are, a trauma-informed response.
Yes, absolutely. And the great news is that we actually have schools, classrooms, communities that are putting this into practice. It's not theory. It's not pie in the sky. There's a lot of examples that I discuss in throughout the book, whether we're talking about in education or healthcare, on the context of work, what have you, in which people are experimenting and practicing new ways of relating to each other that's based in this deep regard and care rather than punishment, discipline, and throwing people out.
So your book is, there's a lot of personal stories. It's almost like a memoir in some parts, and then you get into the academics of it in other parts. But why did you go so personal?
You know, I felt like if I'm asking the reader to do some deep introspection, to reckon with the lies and the stories that you've been told about the world, about each other, then I had to do the same. Like, I have to meet you halfway. And so, for example, talking about the healthcare, you know, challenges that many people face, I wanted to talk about my own experience of birthing my sons and the kinds of supportive community, midwifery care, family kinship that really got me through that as a model for what we can grow in the world, what we can do more of. And so whether it's you know, good examples, things that are heartening and can provide sort of inspiration, or really traumatic examples. For example, my brother's mental illness and incarceration and all of the vicarious trauma associated with that as what we don't want and what we can address differently. I wanted to put myself and my own heart on the page to invite the reader to do the same so that we can work through it together.
Can we go a little deeper on your experience becoming a mother, and why in the United States that is so challenging? We have an astonishing high number of fatalities related to pregnancy in this country.
We do. You know, we do a lot of investment in high-tech healthcare and a lot of reactive when things are really urgent and people are in a very traumatic situation. We have a lot of gear and tech that can kick in, and that can be useful. But we often apply that same approach to areas of our health that need a much more preventative, holistic approach. And childbirth is one of those areas where we treat almost all births as if they require this really high-tech, urgent approach. And that actually becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. We create the emergencies rather than react to them. And so in that context, I talk about working with Black midwives in Georgia in the birth of my first son, and going back and forth between a hospital setting and a home birth setting to learn about how they approach things differently, how I felt different in the context of both. Whereas with the midwife, I felt like she was really listening to me and cared about my own autonomy, where I wasn't just a vessel, but I was a whole human being. And then how that led to a very positive, supportive birthing experience. Whereas often in the hospital setting, I felt like a piece of meat. I felt like my timetable needed to fit with the doctor's timetable. And then so we see, for example, in the context of birth, we have a very, very high rate of cesarean sections in this country, especially when compared to other countries. And that often has a ripple effect in terms of an adverse effect in terms of maternal mortality and the baby's overall health. And so I want us to think about how we approach things, whether it's childbirth or policing or education, and start to question what we assume is natural or inevitable in terms of the way that we do things, and look around for better ways to approach it.
And because of the laws in Georgia, you had essentially was an outlaw birth.
Yes, exactly. If you use a community-based midwife in the home, it's not legally sanctioned. They're working to change that law at the moment, and I've written about that since the book came out.
It's important stuff. Important. We need to talk about that more. So we're going to take a break. We're going to come back. Our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. It's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're discussing the book Viral Justice, How We Grow the World We Want. We're joined by the author, Ruha Benjamin, author, professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, founding director of the Ida B. Jones Just Data Lab, and her new book is Viral Justice. So I don't know how responsible or how much input you had into the actual design of the book, but I'm very taken by this icon that you have in the chapters, kind of dividing ideas. Tell me about that. Is that yours?
Sure. So no, it's actually a symbol, a West African symbol, and the symbol has a meaning. What it looks like is two crocodiles that are joined at the hips. It's called a Siamese crocodile. And essentially, they mark the different sections of the book. And what this Siamese crocodile represents is the idea that we share one stomach, but we fight over food. And so it's a recognition of our interconnectedness as people, but also our foolishness. And so we fight over things when we should really share and think about how to redistribute everything so everyone can live. But instead, we often have conflict over these resources.
So, and that means that people should take a look at, you know, what they're fighting for, how they're fighting for it. And frequently people are pitted against each other to fight over scraps when we have major corporations who are profiting from doing that.
Absolutely. There's so much manipulation. And so the conflict that we are often taught to believe is natural, growing out of our racial differences, our gender class differences, are truly manufactured by the powers that be to keep us scrapping over these little bit of resources when they're often hoarding so much that could be redistributed. And so we have to look around and think about how to channel our anger, channel our energy towards the source of the problems and not each other. And so many of the examples are really inviting us to work together in solidarity, not as like charity, like I'm doing something for you, rather thinking about how we can work together to change, to make the kind of changes in all of these different areas of our lives that can benefit everyone, and take back that power that's often monopolized by those at the top.
So you call on people to plant seeds of growth, of changing the world, but those seeds should come from your passion?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so part of it is to remind ourselves that the problems that we face are produced through so many different avenues, top down, sideways, bottom up, that is from policy in the top, cultural norms that happen horizontally, bottom-up decisions of individuals. It is, the problems are produced through our education, our healthcare, our policing systems. What that means is that all of these are fronts, all of these are arenas in which we can begin to change how we relate to one another, what we invest in. There's a great example that I end the book on that takes us to the city of Seattle, where in the spring 2020, right when I started writing the book, over 200 organizations joined together under the umbrella of what they call the Seattle Solidarity Budget. And what they did is looked around and said, how can we work together? Like, I care about climate, you care about housing, you care about education, but all of these things are interconnected. So what can we do to work together? And what they decided is they looked at the city budget and said, you know, all of these things that we care about are losing out because of how much spending the city is pouring into punishment and policing. Rather than provide housing, they're having these sweeps of homeless encampments. Rather than building more safety, they're investing in digital surveillance. And so they went through the budget line by line and said, how can we shift this investment and these resources? And so over the course of 2 years working together, they successfully got investment in all of these things that they care about and away from policing, which is not helping anything. And so the takeaway there is that a budget, whether we're talking about a city, state, federal budget, is more than a budget. What they say, it's a moral document that tells us who and what we value. And so if we can take that example of looking at the small print, looking at the things that people are ignoring, rather than the big spectacles, what they're showing us on the news or on Twitter, let's look at the fine print and look at how we can shift the values where it's happening in the microscopic areas of our lives.
You write about a gangster gardener, how he's making a difference. Tell me more.
So in my old neighborhood of Los Angeles, a man named Ron Finley looked around his neighborhood and said, wow, it's really hard to buy affordable fresh vegetables. And people are dying of preventable illnesses due to chronic illnesses that relate to their diet and their ability to move around freely. He noticed that dialysis clinics were popping up like Starbucks in our neighborhood. And so he decided to do something about it right in his front yard. He looked at the little patch of green grass that's often dried up. We call them parkways in LA. It's between the sidewalk and the street. And he said, what if I planted an edible garden right in my front yard? And initially the city cited him and issued an arrest warrant because it wasn't lawful, but he worked together with other neighbors and people who supported him. They got the law changed and now there are edible gardens popping up around the city. They've created a teaching garden to employ residents in the neighborhood. And so this idea is catching on all over, not just LA, but around the country, thinking about urban gardening just as a way of thinking about food justice and being able to grow, literally in this case, growing the world we want. want, but thinking about that as a metaphor for getting our hands dirty right where we are, in our backyards, in our front yards, with our neighbors, and not waiting for someone to give us permission to do that.
Your previous book looked at how technology, the racism that we have in our society is being, embedded in our new technology. Real quickly, can you talk about that?
Yeah, a lot of people had, until recently at least, thought of technology as neutral and as kind of asocial, apolitical in its own little bubble. In the last few years, that bubble has been burst, and more people are aware of the way that algorithms are shaping not just our social media, but so many of our life chances, like whether you can get a home loan or get a car loan or whether you get admitted to a school or how a job interview goes because they're evaluating you through a video recording and an algorithm. And so these technologies are not neutral. They reflect the values and the priorities of the people that design them and the people that commission those designs. And so a quick concrete example, there recently, last year or two, it was found a group of researchers audited a healthcare algorithm that was making decisions about patients' care. Millions of patients all over the country were subjected to this decision, automated decision making, where they would get more or less service and attention based on what the risk score of this algorithm spit out. And not too surprisingly, Black patients were routinely, they were receiving much fewer services and attention because of the way this algorithm was designed. And so I think about like my grandma's generation who, she was born in Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, moved to Atlanta, and then she moved to Texas. My dad was born in Houston. And I think about how she would go up to a hospital and see a whites only sign, or she would see a arrow pointing to the Negro wing, which would inevitably be much more run down and not a lot of resources there. So the discrimination in her generation was in her face. Like, there was no hiding it. Now I can walk through the front door of a hospital and it seem like I'm getting the same kind of service, but based on what these algorithms are spitting out, then you have someone sitting there behind the computer making decisions about my care that might be having the very same kind of discriminatory effect in terms of the resources that are being allocated. And the danger is that I don't even know about it. It's not in my face. It's happening behind a screen, and the person administering my care doesn't even have to dislike me or hate me. They can just be doing their job, but they're assuming that that algorithm or that technology is neutral, and that's perpetuating the problem. And so this is what I call the new Jim Code, because my grandma lived under the Jim Crow era. And so now I want us to think about how these codes, these algorithms and technologies are hiding, they're speeding up, they're scaling up the forms of anti-Black discrimination that are encoded, again, into our everyday practices, whether in healthcare, education, or finance. And so I hope that by naming it, we can start to organize against it and to demand that our social values of equity and justice become encoded into our socio-technical systems as we move forward.
So when I apply for a job online through some sort of LinkedIn type of a thing, it will go through an algorithm before a human will ever get to it, or they may never get to it, depending upon that computer program. And if it has a built-in bias unknowingly, but it's there because it was built by white men, it's a barrier that prevents people from having an equal opportunity.
Absolutely. I think, what I want to just remind us is that an algorithm has to be trained to make a decision. And so in the context of that you just described in work, oftentimes the training of that employment algorithm is based on who has already climbed through the ranks in that industry or in that particular organization. And oftentimes that is a very small demographic that has been promoted, that has been hired for, let's say it's trained on the past 20 years of hiring and promotion. And so if you've had human bias that's been part of that, which as sociologists have documented is very common, that you can have an employer getting thousands of resumes, and just by the name on the resume, they're more likely to call back the seemingly white applicants versus the Black applicants based on the name. So that is very well documented. Now, let's say we're training that algorithm on right. Those human practices. And we're going to see it reproduce that same form of bias, but now it's hidden.
So we need to be observant. We need to challenge these things. We need to be inventive. We need to work towards change. And there's more about that in the book, Viral Justice, How We Grow the World We Want. And Ruha Benjamin, author, thank you so much for joining us. It was great talking with you. I sure do appreciate you coming on board. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Dallas Williams and Megan Halbadir Moore, with production assistance provided by Mark Hutchison. Dan Katz is TPR's news director. Support for The Source comes from contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.